But of course, the Constitution does allow for two ministers to be brought in from outside of politics to be appointed to the Seanad. Would it not have been a good idea, perhaps in Brian Cowan's time, particularly when we were in crisis, to bring somebody like a Michael O'Leary into?
Yeah, he'd be great. And if you think I'm going to rise to that, you have no hope about at all. Somebody bewailed in some review that did, they gave me a really good review on this, but she never spoke about Michael O'Leary. I don't have to give him oxygen. He has all the oxygen he needs.
Do you dislike Michael O'Leary? Given that he's a neighbour of yours, isn't he, in Mullingar?
Not quite a neighbour, about 60 miles away.
Yeah. Is he that far away?
Well,
is
50
he?
Anyway, yes.
Oh, that's a fair bit away.
It is. I don't have to
He caused you a lot of problems, though, as minister, didn't he? I mean, he really used to get stuck into you big time, didn't he?
Yeah, myself and Bertie had big things about it, sure, he had. Used to have big ads.
But what do you make about these successes? I mean, you look at the size of Ryanair now. About 10 times the size of Aer Lingus.
It's a marvellous success. Nobody's taken that from him at all.
And yet he used to always complain that the government was against him. Your government.
He adores this government. He just licks his lips and adores them. I don't know.
But would it not be a good idea to have people, if not Michael O'Leary, the ilk of Michael O'Leary, brought in to serve in government?
Somebody like him. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think there's something to be gained by having a person who has actually been elected because he or she knows what the country's like, what it's functioning like.
But then doesn't that come back to the thing that often politicians just give people what they say they want rather than what's good for them? That maybe a little bit of tough love is what's required at times rather than always going out courting votes.
Well, we sure have tough love now, haven't we? The last 4 years, really tough love.
Tell me, going back to your time as Minister for Public Enterprise, do you regret the sale of Aircom?
No.
No?
No. And I mean, I heard you and many, many others, and you didn't know what you were talking about, if you don't mind me saying so. It's a rude thing to say that to an interviewer.
No,
but
please explain
Colin
in more detail.
Colin McCarthy wrote the best article ever I saw on Aircom only about 6 or 9 months ago. He said, I wish commentators would just shut up, saying it was a disaster. He said, first of all, it got a great price for the government. Charlie McGreevy put all the money into the pension fund, from which people are always saying we could draw money from the pension fund. He put it into it. For 12 months, people could get their money plus 20%. Well, what more can you want? I mean, people say
a national telecoms infrastructure, which is to the benefit of the country and to the economy. The investment in broadband, Aircom has not invested anything like it should have
they're
done over the last
They're beginning to do it
day.
Now. They are doing it.
They're doing a fraction of what is
actually required.
I don't
think
required.
They would. I think there was a, we sold at a good price. The country gained. Pat Rabbit said at the time, they're selling at a Moore Street price. Imagine. If we got a good price, we got...
But you sold the infrastructure. You sold the national infrastructure into private hands raped the company.
But Matt, wasn't it better that we sold it openly than what previously happened? If it all comes out that way, I don't want to go into it because I don't want to prejudice what might happen with regard to the earlier awarding of a licence.
But that's a very different story.
Yes, I know, but I just want to say to you, we sold it openly in a marketplace.
But the point is, should it have been sold at all? Should this not have been one of the things that should have been kept in state ownership?
No. I don't think it could. And I think that when you say the family silver and they go on money and groaning about family silver, that's not true. I mean, you don't know, but I didn't see any dynamism within Telecom as it then was. Later,
yes, renamed Aircom for the flotation,
that's right.
Yes.
I didn't see any great dynamism to start doing A, B, C, D, E. We thought it was a good, but the cribbing or the carping that goes on about it is always based on, oh, the money, the people lost the money. They had it for 12 months. And if they didn't sell within 12 months, they were really looking for Cinderella land or Pollyanna land or something. And equally, we got a very good price for it in a public marketplace.
Okay, what's the future for Mary O'Rourke now? You've
finished
the book.
I'm going to write another book.
About what?
I'm going to write a book, a historical book. I have no time for novels or romance or all of that, though I had loads of it in my life, but that's another day's work. I'm going to write a book.
Oh, okay, maybe we'll take an extra couple of minutes so you can tell us all about it. Is all the romance detailed in the book, or is the stuff that you've kept out?
You didn't read my book. I'm disgusted. I wouldn't have come into you now.
I have read the book.
If I hadn't thought you had the book.
I won't go into some of this. The surprise that I might have had at the intimacy that you revealed in the book.
Yes, People are haunted by infertility. People are haunted by adoption. People are haunted by those. They're human issues.
Very much so.
I went through every single one of them.
Yes, and I mean, you write quite movingly about it. I have to say, I'm just almost surprised by the level of detail that you did about it.
Yes, I think it was right to be open and public about them if you are going to. I've had that height of letters from about those two problems of which I spoke to you. There's a lot of it in the world today. There was a lot of it then, but it wasn't.
And IVF wasn't available at the time.
No, there was no
people.
IVF. No, there wasn't. And you had to go and do all your own measures, whatever way they worked out for you. But I was lucky, and Enda was keen to have children, same as I was. And we went about it in a kind of a structured, right way.
Mechanical way, almost.
Sort of, yes, yeah. And when I went to Devonair, my friend used to say to Dr. Devonair, the gynaecologist, did you have to go to a Fianna Fáil one? I'm not at all.
Actually, the question
just
I asked today.
To be.
The future. Do you write a book? Have you a historical figure in mind?
I have, yes. I have a family called.
I love helping others. I give a great time in giving. I love meeting people. I love chatting to Patrick there, or Mary, meeting the security guy below and find out what he's. Lovely Thomas, taxi driver, brought me down and I asked him what he thought about one or two things. I love talking to people and listening to them, listening to their story and helping. You know, as I said before, you know, the least thing that interests me is money. Any money I have, I seem to either give away, spend it, or, you know, it doesn't interest me. If I'm broke tomorrow, that's where I came from, that's where I'm going back to. Yes, I prefer not to be broke, but you know, I just like it. I enjoy it. I don't.
Do people help you?
Oh, that's a good question. I've never been asked that question all my years. I suppose I haven't needed too much help. It'd be interesting to know. There's great feeling of goodwill I feel all the time, but
I'll ask you. So recently, and it was very high profile when you broke up your engagement with Lisa Murphy.
Yeah.
Broke up.
Yeah.
Were there many people who came to your assistance?
Yeah,
then,
there was,
came
actually
to your support.
Yeah, I'd have to say there really was. Yeah, it was hundreds of messages of support for a start, but there was a lot of very close friends. A lot of my friends go back a long way, if you know what I mean. And there was a lot of close friends. Yeah. Yeah, there was. That's a very good point, because I'd forgotten that bit. Yeah, I would. Nobody would have disappointed me, if that's a good way of saying it. You know, there's nobody I can think of. And if there was, I would say there was, but I wouldn't name that person, if you know what I mean.
You mentioned John F. Kennedy and where you were when he died. But Robert Kennedy,
yeah.
Tell us about where you were then and how you became so centrally involved.
I was in, I had become friends with Robert Kennedy, which is not a good idea for journalists to become friends. You can respect people and not become close to them. But I was close to him, and I had agreed to help write some speeches for the campaign when he announced, and then knew I wasn't made out for that. I lasted about 3 weeks doing that, but I was covering it. And I liked him very much. I think he learned from the tragedy of his brother not to wait. You're not going to have maybe a second term in life. You better get it done now. There was an urgency to him that I liked very much. And he would do things like call me and say, what are you doing? He says, nothing. You want to take a ride? I'm going out to Bed-Stuy and just see how people are doing out there. And that's all it was. He wasn't trying to be written about or anything. He wanted to get out of a car and talk to people sitting on stoops in August when they had no air conditioning. Me and a couple of other guys, Jack Newfield and others. But that night, in June, we had already gone through the murder of Martin Luther King in April. And that night in June, I was sitting upstairs with him in the hotel, the Ambassador Hotel, and three or four other people in the room, just watching some of the early television returns. And then said, okay, we got to go down. It was time to go down and make the speech on to Chicago, etc. And we took a shortcut through what was essentially a kind of giant scullery of some kind. And the last time I saw him alive, he was turning to his left over his shoulder to shake hands with a Mexican short order cook, or busboy, rather. I went out of Nowhere came Sirhan, Sirhan. Bang, 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 bang. I still have my notes that reflect the bangs. And then he was on the ground, and I was with Plimpton and some other guys trying to get this guy with the gun across these steam tables to the far end of that area, because we didn't want, you know, another Jack Ruby or something. Keep him alive, find out what this is about. And I went back to see Bobby lying on the floor, Ethel beside him. Blood on his fingertips of one hand, so one hand must have brushed against the bullet wound. And the glassiness in his eyes, he lived another 24 hours. And it was as if a hole had been blown through the country. Because to have Jack, then to have King, then to have Bobby all murdered. Meanwhile, Malcolm X thrown into the hopper too, another voice of eloquence of a different kind. And I was filled with a kind of despair. And I wasn't alone. I don't mean this is about how I felt. It was about a whole lot of other people. And for the first time in my life, after I wrote the story of the shooting and after I covered the funeral, first time in my life I'd had a writer's block. And I remember coming home after a month and a half from California, finally back to New York. And I had lunch with Paul O'Dwyer from Mayo, a great old left-wing lawyer, one of the best people I ever knew in my life. And he said, "Well, what are you writing?" I said, "Nothing, Paul. I got a writer's block." He looks at me and he says, "Huck," he says, "you're not important enough to have a writer's block." And I laughed out loud, and I've been writing ever since.
Well, the bottom line for the Iona Institute is that children need a mother and a father, should have a mother and a father ideally, and that a marriage between a man and a woman is the best way to give children the security and the stability they need.
Sorry, hold on. Isn't that again, and I'll ask you what your position as much as the Iona Institute's, is that not discriminatory against couples, often heterosexual couples, who do not have children, as if their marriage is in some way less because they don't have children? And does it not also, if two consenting adults, be they of the same sex, want to make a commitment to each other in marriage and believe strongly in that, why should they be denied that as citizens of the state?
Well, the Iona Institute believes that any couples in caring relationships should have legal rights and legal protection. So we don't discriminate against homosexuals or against any couples in that regard. We just believe that marriage is unique, and of course some couples don't have children either because they don't want to or because they can't. That's not an issue. But we believe that all of the research that is available points to the benefits of a stable relationship between a man and a woman.
How is that stable relationship in any way impacted upon if homosexual people also choose to marry, if they choose to make a commitment to themselves? And I ask you as a psychiatrist, what does it do for somebody's sense of self-worth and self-value if they're told that because of their sexuality, they are not entitled to the same legal protection of marriage as a heterosexual couple?
Well, they can have all of the other protections. It's the word marriage.
You're discriminating.
It's what the word. Well, it's a different. You don't discriminate when there are different situations. We have to think about children and the relationship between a man and a woman in marriage. Having children is very different from two homosexual men or two homosexual women.
How is the position of any child in any marriage affected by homosexual couples marrying?
Well, the all of the evidence is that the children do best in a relationship where a man and a woman are married. There's the information, the science that we have on gay marriage and on gay marriage, but be it male or female marriage, is very limited indeed in relation to how children do. There are some studies, but the numbers are small. They're often self-selected. So, you know, we have to be careful and base our social policy on good evidence. And the evidence doesn't exist at the moment. That's not to say it won't exist in the future.
I'm going to pick that up with you again. I need to take a break. Professor Patricia Casey is with us, and we will return to this interview after this short break. I want to continue with Professor Patricia Casey, who is with us, and I want to go back to this issue. We were talking about marriage for homosexual and lesbian couples and the Ion Institute's position against that. As a psychiatrist, do you not have a duty to look at scientific research and results rather than depending on your own moral views and your own religious beliefs to inform you as to what's best for people?
I think, Matt, before we broke for the interval, I said that we have to base all our views on science. And that's the purpose of a think tank like the Iona Institute. The idea is to look at the evidence and base our thinking on that. And, you know, in relation to...
Sorry, are you not based on religious beliefs?
No, we're not a Catholic institute.
Or a Christian institution?
No, we're not. We support the role of religion in society, but we are not a religiously based organisation.
Can you understand why people might find that hard to believe, that think that perhaps you're trying to operate under some sort of cover?
Well, I don't know why people would believe that. I mean, we talk about religion because we believe that religion has a place in society.
And are you all practicing Catholics?
How do you mean all? I mean, I'm a patron. There are four patrons. I am a practicing Catholic. I think Breda O'Brien is Vincent
yes,
Toomey.
Yes, very definitely.
Vincent Toomey is. And I yes. can't think who the fourth. There is a fourth patron whose name escapes me at the moment.
People like David Quinn, former editor of the Irish Catholic, very clearly. So all of the main people, the main spokespeople for the Ion Institute, are clearly very strong Catholic believers.
Well, I don't know how strong their beliefs are. I mean, you can ask me how strong my beliefs are, and I can tell you in honesty, they wax and wane at times. During times in the past, I have not believed in God. You know, my son had cancer when he was five. My younger son had cancer when he was five. And it was a terribly dark time. And I certainly did not believe in God at that time.
Did he survive that?
He did. He survived, thank goodness.
And did that strengthen your faith then that he survived?
Not especially, no.
Because it was medicine rather than prayer that saved him.
It was medicine. It was medicine. Now, some people to some of my patients who thank me when I treat them and they get well and they say thank you, Professor Casey. And I say, well, it's not me, it's the medicine, you know, and it was the medicine. Some people, of course, might say that the doctors, you know, were given the gifts that they had to discover the medicines from God. I take a much more scientific and simple view of it, really.
Well, I'm delighted now to be joined by Barry Sonnenfeld, who is the director of the Men in Black trilogy. He also did The Addams Family and Get Shorty. And when I was looking back through his CV, I saw that as a cinematographer, he was responsible for some absolutely brilliant movies as well, like Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Miller's Crossing, all with the Coen brothers, and movies like When Harry Met Sally and Throw Mama from the Train. Barry, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Well, it's a pleasure. And what's funny is I think you said Men in Back instead of Men in Black. And what's funny about that was the porn name of the when Men in Black was released, the first Men in Black, it was called Men in Back. So I thought, boy, that brings back. Boy, you must be quite the aficionado of my work, although I did have nothing to do with that one.
But you were aware of it.
I also shot When Harry Met Sally. Well, we can't go into that, but yeah.
Why can't you go into that?
Well, no, I was going to say, and one day I was at my local video store returning a video, and I saw that there was a porn video. My wife and I saw there was a porn video called When Harry Ate Sally. And what was funny is that we were about to go visit Rob Reiner, the director, for dinner. So it was $10. It was a used video. I bought it for him and thought that would be quite amusing. And he looked at the tape and said, is this supposed to be funny? And I said, well, kind of. and he said, I don't find it amusing. So I said, well, can I have it back? So my wife and I had a good time that night.
This is not where I expected the interview to go, which was absolutely fantastic.
Perhaps no one else will ever hear any of this.